Welcome to What Are You Reading, a podcast dedicated to leadership development through commitment to reading.
This is your host, Ryder Ashcraft. Today, I am joined by retired U.S. Public Health Services Rear Admiral Kenneth Bernard. Admiral Bernard advises U.S. government agencies and private institutions on issues related to security, defense, intelligence, and health. Dr. Bernard was appointed by President George W. Bush to be the Special Assistant to the President for Biodefense on the Homeland Security Council in November 2002. Dr. Bernard chaired the White House Biodefense Policy Coordinating Committee and drafted decision directives for President Bush on both biodefense for the 21st century and agricultural bioterrorism. He was the White House point person on Project BioShield, a $5.6 billion congressional bill that is speeding development and procurement of new countermeasures against biological, chemical, and radiological terrorist threats. Dr. Bernard has an MD from the University of California, Davis, a DTMNH from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, is board certified in internal medicine, and is a member on the Council on Foreign Relations. Sir, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
First question, what are you currently reading?
Oh, that's a tough one because I spend so much time in social media that I spend more time doing that than actually reading books. But I am reading Sapiens, which is highly recommended, about what our species is doing and why they're doing it. I'm also reading Warnings by Dick Clark and Arpietti. Dick Clark, you may recall, is the former advisor to Bill Clinton and George Bush for a bit on counterterrorism. It's very good.
Do you find that the books you read for pleasure have changed over the years? Like, are these themes something that you were reading as a, you know, young officer in the U.S. Public Health Services?
I'm maybe a bit peculiar in that I mostly read for pleasure, not nonfiction. I mean, I'll read some nonfiction, but usually my day is so filled with getting down to the facts, coming up with decisions, doing options, that I'm really looking forward to something that's a little bit less demanding on my thinking. I can just kind of lay back and enjoy it.
I'm sure a good portion of our audience, especially those in the military who have to read briefs and intel reports and whatnot every single day, feel the same way, sir.
Oh, absolutely. And for a long time in my career, I wrote those briefs. In fact, most of my career. The only difference as you get up in rank is you write them for more important people, but you still end up doing the same three-page option papers just like you did when you were in 04.
So, sir, I think that many of our listeners, and myself included, are fairly unfamiliar with the United States Public Health Services, another branch of the Uniformed Services. Could you describe the structure and function for us?
Well, the Public Health Service is one of the 7 or 8 uniformed services. I forget how many. I think it's 8. But they're not military. And they were formed, actually, back in the late 1700s. As a medical corps to take care of our merchant marine and to run merchant marine's hospitals. Because you may remember that back in the day when foreign policy was basically trade, you traded with England or you traded with France, and your success as a country depended on open trade routes and trading with major nations around the world. So the original U.S. government founding fathers decided that we needed to protect our merchant marine, who were in fact as important as our regular military, because they kept trade routes open, they moved goods back and forth, and provided for the national security as well as national economic good. Anyway, this group of public health or health people slowly transformed into a national public health service. Whether they were doing quarantines for cholera and smallpox, or whether they got involved with malaria control in the South. And over time, this same group of people, their jobs just kept changing to what was needed during the day. Now, the Public Health Service has major personnel in FDA, Centers for Disease Control, National Institutes of Health, other parts of Health and Human Services, and some of them are detailed to other places, like other uniformed services as well.
So, sir, why do you think it is important to have uniformed members in these public health positions rather than just a separate, you know, non-uniform service overall for public health?
Well, almost the entire service is officers. Maybe the entire service is officers. And so it's really not like the normal military service. However, the advantages to a member of the public health service is they can get reassigned to a different job, a different agency, a different location with just orders. It's easy. And their salaries and pay goes up the same way it does in the military, same pay grades, same scale, everything. Physicians get, you know, special bonuses, but they do in the military as well. So it's very good. You know, I was almost 30 years in the public health service. It's was really great for me because I worked in 6 or 8 jobs, completely different. Never would have been able to do that without being in having a common personnel system and a common command system. As far as the whether or not this could be done outside the uniform services, I suppose so, but it was, it's got a long history, and it also allows a certain esprit de corps like the other services do. You're not just working for a faceless federal bureaucracy. And the other is that they can be called up with, it takes essentially a signature to actually call them up and put them under the Coast Guard, Navy, whatever, as a military service. So in times of crisis, that has been considered. I don't think it's been done, but it's been considered. And then, of course, you're getting an assignment to someplace you don't want to go is not your choice.
I think a lot of our audience can relate to most of what you just said. Getting called up, assignment is not maybe your favorite choice.
Exactly. And we're very lucky because we basically get to choose where we want to go. And as long as it's peacetime, you know, we can always quit if they don't get it. We leave the Corps. But most of the time, they're pretty reasonable. And it's small enough. There's only about 6,000 members. So it's pretty easy to move around and to make the personnel system work.
So you said that they haven't really called a bunch of people up in a time of crisis. Do you know what a like wartime posture would look like for the public health services?
They would probably almost certainly be detailed to one of the other services, one of the military services, to help if it was had to do with refugees. They're all health people. So they would be assigned to health affairs at defense, or they'd be assigned to at one of the service hospitals. It's a ready backup force. And their expertise, of course, is public health and not so much clinical care, although there is a substantial number that do clinical care either in the Indian Health Service or elsewhere. So there is a backup group that could do clinical care, but a lot of it would have to do with the actual public health issues, pandemics, biologic attacks on, say, the warfighter somewhere, and it's where their expertise is and where they could be of most use.
All right, so I definitely want to come back to that in a few minutes, but first I'd like to circle back to a point that you made earlier about, you know, you were writing briefs and the higher you got in your career, the more important people read them and whatnot. And I think that a lot of our listeners, and especially those in the military who have, you know, between 5 and 10 years of service at this point, would probably agree that it's not really easy to see the impact of one's actions when you're serving, you know, at these mid-grade levels. It's a little easier to see them at higher levels in government. Do you have any advice for these public servants or service members that are in that mid-grade level that haven't quite reached those command levels yet and are not really in positions to affect large policy changes?
Yeah, that's a common question, not only in the military. I get it all the time from people who are interested in foreign policy, national security, international relations, that kind of thing. You kind of have to wait your turn, which is both part of the advantage and part of the problem. A lot of the decisions that are being made at the highest levels now are made by people who were trained during the Cold War, right? So you have decisions that are the decision makers are people who don't view a lot of the things that we're dealing with today in the same light as they deal with, say, binational confrontational politics, US-Russia, US-China, something like a pandemic or bio warfare or, you know, refugee disasters and that kind of thing are not really on their front burner. I think that's going to be changing. I'll get into that in a few minutes. But if I were to make a recommendation for the mid-level professional who's interested in national security issues, is that they first off take a joint assignment somewhere. See if you can find one of those that's interesting. I think, as much as I hate to say it, the services are pretty stovepiped. And I had a very, very good friend who was an 06, and he got passed over for flag because a box was not checked on his in his record. He did not command a battalion in, you know, Nebraska or something, and it cost him his promotion, even though he was one of the world's experts on biodefense and biosecurity. But the service command structure for promotions is pretty ossified sometimes. So I think Goldwater Nichols did everybody a big favor. Some people don't like it, but I think it was really good because it allowed people with kind of unusual interests, interests that are not your standard line warfighter interests, to actually become successful and do interesting jobs within the DoD framework. So joint assignments, get assigned to a different agency. I mean, get assigned to the State Department to be a mil aide somewhere. Do something to get out of the normal vertical structure in the service if you want to move away from your standard line authority.
So transitioning into what you said about we're not living in a Cold War anymore, and while there are binational confrontations that are very much on at the forefront of people's concerns, policy priorities, you know, especially US and China right now, maybe still a little bit US and Russia, there are events that affect the entire world, pandemic being one of them. So you're a specialist in biosecurity. This is an area that combines public health and national security issues. What future threats are we facing as a nation right now that would impact our readiness in the future to fight at the highest levels?
Well, I think the big threats remain the existential threats. Nuclear, of course, still top of the list. We seem to be past our major concerns about that, but we should never forget it. The triad's still necessary. We still have to put substantial work and personnel into protecting America. I think we are going to have to consider terrorism again. We kind of let it slide for a few years there after 9/11. It was all the rage among the military and civilian sectors. And then we didn't have a big problem for a while, and we let it slide. I think Afghanistan is a critical reminder that it's not gone away, and we're going to have to deal with that in the future. But there are a lot of transnational issues that have not been traditional national security problems, like climate, like pandemics, you know, water supply, for example. There are a lot of things that are going to destabilize regions of the world that are going to be a real problem. We also have the creeping autocratic governments and creeping fascism around the world. I won't name the specific governments or nations, but it's pretty obvious that democracy is in some respects under attack. And so I think we're going to have to be vigilant for that too. And I think that as a result of that, a lot of the senior brass in the military are going to have to go back to school, so to speak, and start dealing with the issues that these transnational issues that they've not really had to deal with to a great degree in the past. And it's hard. I mean, back in, you know, you may recall during the Ebola epidemic, it really wasn't a pandemic except in West Africa. President Obama and Susan Rice, the National Security Advisor at the time, were adamant that the uniformed military was going to be involved in response to the pandemic in West Africa. And they were quite clear to the chairman, the joint staff, that they would be involved. And the chairman at the time set out a series of issues that the defense would be responsible for, or at least responsive to requests, and things that they wouldn't do. And, you know, airlift and, you know, creating, building hospitals in the field and that kind of thing they would do. But they would not take care of direct patient care. They would not expose the warfighter to direct patient care of Africans with Ebola. There was a big interagency process involved with putting the United States with a single whole of government approach to dealing with the epidemic of Ebola in West Africa. And there was a former Special Forces colonel who was in charge of coordinating for DOD. And he was very good and very responsive, but corralling all the different agencies within DOD plus the different services plus SOLIC and all the variety of places where people thought they either did or did not have a part of action for the Department of Defense was really difficult. But the most critical thing that I learned from that is we did an after action for this at the end of the U.S. response to the epidemic in Africa. And in talking with this colonel, he said, "We came, we did what we were told. I'm now washing my hands of it. This is not our mission. This is not our job. Thank you very much. Bye-bye." And I was shocked because the way that you deal with other events like this, and we are going to have more pandemics, whether natural, intentional, or accidental, and DOD will be involved. It's not whether they will be involved. And it seems like those who feel that the mission of DOD does not include these are still in command positions, at least in some command positions. I'm hopeful that that's changing, and that when people with a broader view of what is actually a national security issue get up into senior command positions, they will become much more welcoming to broadening the mission of the Defense Department to deal with national security issues that are not quite the same as they were 50 years ago.
So do you think there are any steps that we can take right now to educate, to prevent, to get ahead of these problems? Because, you know, in a warfighting scenario, if we're in a near peer level competition in the future, but we're also dealing with a pandemic, whether it is, like you said, caused naturally, intentionally, accidentally, combined with climate change, like these are a lot of different, very large balls for the Department of Defense, the Department of State, the whole government complex to be juggling. What can we do now to get ahead of this problem, to prepare ourselves to be able to pivot to in so many different directions?
Very good question. We have to do something other than sit back and wait for the next one, which is the concern I have for the Defense Department is you can't define your mission as not involving these broader transnational issues because you will be having to deal with them whether you want to or not. The secret is to put together a standing group at the Defense Department whose job it is to prepare for the next one. Now, whether that let's just narrow it to pandemics or biologic attacks. I mean, there should be 20 or 30 people somewhere at the Defense Department whose job it is to have an ongoing preparedness and planning portfolio. I mean, the Joint Staff does it all the time. You have all of these playbooks for every possible way that Russia could invade Poland. I mean, you know, there's no reason you can't put together playbooks for another pandemic or different kinds of pandemics or a biologic attack at the Defense Department. And they would contribute what defense does best. No one does logistics better than defense. the Army especially, right? Nobody does airlift better than the Department of Defense. No one in the world. So, you know, those particular capacities should be pre-planned to help if this kind of thing should happen before, happen again. And then there has to be a combatant commander. And in fact, I wrote about this recently in an article in Newsweek. There has to be a combatant commander for biosecurity and pandemic preparedness, just like there's a combatant commander for, you know, what is it, 11 other combatant commands, some of them functional, like special forces, and some of them regional, like CENTCOM. There should be one in the U.S. government somewhere, an equivalent combatant commander that can pull together all of the agencies, be them HHS, USAID, State Department, Defense, and make sure that we're on a common path of planning, exercising, making sure that we know what we're going to do and what we'll be called on when the shoe drops the next time. And that's the, we did this actually in the Bush administration back in 2003, when we did the first biodefense strategy for the US. And because it was post 9/11 and post the anthrax attacks, we had everybody's attention. Everybody wanted to be involved. But as time went on, people got less and less involved because they didn't see the need on a year-to-year, month-to-month, or year-to-year basis. But then again, we had the Ebola in 2014, and now we have the pandemic in 2019, 20, 21 of COVID. So it's all going to repeat itself. And the important part is that we plan between the crises, just like they do in the rest of the Defense Department, for the next crisis. And they have, you know, one of, was I forget, is it J5 plans? There are whole groups that do nothing but planning in the Defense Department and the Joint Staff. And they need to add planning for these kinds of scenarios. Saying that it's not our mission is just not going to fly. As soon as the president says it's your mission, it's your mission. He's the commander in chief. And that's what happened with Obama and Ebola. Pushback, pushback, pushback from defense until the commander in chief said, this is what you're going to do. So they sent in the 82nd Airborne or something, or maybe it was the 102nd. And they, you know, maybe that wasn't the best solution. What they needed was a group from defense that knew how to call on the right resources to add value added to the U.S. response. And that just requires planning and not very many people. They just have to be the point group at defense for dealing with these transnational issues.
So you've talked about the need for planning. I think that that is very well established. But you also mentioned earlier that there are triggers that can inspire, if you will, groups within the government to be more proactive, get ahead of these crises, anthrax being the trigger back in the early 2000s. We kind of saw an immediate and very robust response for COVID at the beginning of the pandemic, but just due to the longevity of the pandemic and, you know, that we've learned more about how the disease works, we have vaccinations now, we do have a plan for overall, but it just has taken a very, very long time and it doesn't seem to be slowing down very much, especially with the Delta variant. So for large scale, long-term crises and events, how do we maintain that level of preparedness or forward thinking to anticipate, you know, the next step and maybe eventually end the crisis so that we can focus on the next one?
It has to do with leadership. And it has to do with the president backing a combatant commander for biosecurity and pandemic preparedness. And that combatant commander should be, for want of another place, in the White House. The reason for that is every agency sees preparedness for, say, pandemics as not their job, with the exception, perhaps, of part of Health and Human Services. But as we've seen, the effect of the pandemic has affected our education. It's affected our military readiness with vaccination of the warfighter. It's affected and the outbreaks on ships. It's affected our economy. It is not a health issue. It is a whole of government existential issue. And to assign it to the Department of Health and Human Services is to give the other agencies a free pass. The way it works best, and I know because I was a special assistant to the two presidents on this issue, the White House, National Security Council especially, has the ability to call meetings and to demand, because they represent the president, that the other agencies pick up the slack in what needs to be done based on their inherent advantages and missions. So they have to listen to the NSC because they speak for the president. If you put this out in an agency like Health and Human Services, this planning for the next one, it just doesn't work. I know it doesn't work. And unfortunately, I just saw last week, Eric Lander and Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor and the head of the Office of Science Technology Policy, put out a plan called American Pandemic Preparedness, Transforming Our Capabilities. It's fabulous. Unfortunately, they want mission control, as they say, to be in the Department of Health and Human Services. I just don't see it working. The Department of Defense hardly has to answer a phone call from anybody at the Department of Health and Human Services. I know. I used to try to call defense from Health and Human Services. And, you know, you get pushed down. You're told to talk to a mid-level person at Health Affairs who can't make a decision anyway. So the control, the command and control of something inherently involving every department in the government, from the intelligence community to the Department of the Treasury, to DOD, to state, to HHS, has to be in an organization that's more senior than any of those. And the only one that works is at the White House, presumably at the NSC or affiliated with the NSC. I've been saying this for 15 years, and every time they don't do it, we have a problem. I mean, part of the mess that happened with COVID in the Trump administration was because they abolished an Office of Health Security in 2018 that had a senior director and a number of staff that should have been an office three times the size that was in charge. If they had been in charge and had been doing the job that needed to be done, we would have had a command structure already in place to coordinate a U.S. response. But it was never set up that way. And then it was abolished. So then when January of 2020, when everybody suddenly started noticing the problem with COVID, there was no innate intact command structure. So they put together these task forces, first headed by the Secretary of Health, which didn't work, of course, and then headed by the Vice President, which became so politicized that it didn't work either. This administration has done a good job in putting in people like Jeff Zients as head of the COVID task force. And, you know, the people at the NSC know what they're doing on this. But it's still not a unified approach to dealing with pandemics and biosecurity that should have been in place before the pandemic so that the response would have been rapid and the various agencies, including defense, would have known what they were going to be required to do.
So projecting into the future, if you had a crystal ball, besides, you know, potential future pandemics, what do you see as the biggest health threat to national security, to our ability to, you know, man and have a force ready to defend the United States if necessary?
The biggest health threat is preparedness planning. It is not the lack thereof. It is not any one specific disease. It used to be, we used to say, well, we need to look at the tier one bio threats, you know, the Ebola viruses and the smallpox and anthrax. But we know now that a laboratory in Canada produced horsepox from mail-in DNA fragments that they bought online, produced horsepox. And it's just as easy to produce smallpox as it is to produce horsepox for $100,000. So the specific threat that we're facing, we can't react to like we did in the old days where we worried about Russia making anthrax in Novosibirsk. What we need to worry about now is people, competency, and bioterrorist use of maybe state-supported bioterrorist use of perhaps genetically engineered new viruses and or pathogens. Anthrax resistant to all antibiotics, for example, or some chimeric flu combined with smallpox or something, you know, that's technically feasible to do. And we need to be prepared for that. The problem is, how do you buy countermeasures or how do you prepare countermeasures for something that you don't know you're going to be attacked with or that's going to even occur naturally or be or run into when you in the wild, like people usually get Ebola by eating bushmeat or whatever. So it's a tough problem. What you need to do is do what they do at DARPA and other places, is try to prepare platforms that can quickly pivot to prepare countermeasures or to deal with responding to whatever pathogen or ever biologic agent happens to float along. But that requires organizational preparedness. And you have to be ready to find a way to deal with it, both in the warfighter as well as in the civilian populations. That's the big problem. It's not the specific pathogen. It's not the specific agent. It's our ability to pivot quickly, respond, be prepared, and respond to whatever happens to come our way.
All right. Thank you, sir. Well, I have one last question for you. Do you have any other words of wisdom or encouragement for our DoD Reads audience?
Yeah, I think some of the smartest and most strategic decision makers I have ever met in my life have been flag officers in the military. Those of you who know General Zinni, for example. I mean, these guys are really, really smart. And they got that way by learning about things that are beyond what is told to you to deal with in order to get promoted from 03 to 04, 04 to 05. You need to go back to school. You need to take every advantage of doing joint assignments or doing interesting assignments and that may not necessarily look like they're career enhancing, but they enhance your ability to move outside the normal stovepipe. I think it's critical that in our education, in the various schools that you go to, in the war colleges, in the graduate schools in Boston and Washington, School of Foreign Service, the Kennedy School, and all the war colleges, that you deal with the non-traditional, non-Cold War issues. Because at some point, the 04 and the 05 today is going to be the 08 and the 09 of tomorrow. And you need to be aware of the broad-based assaults on our national security, not just the clear and present danger of China and Russia, but the broader, more difficult ones to deal with, such as pandemics, climate change, whatever. And I think if you get that education at the 04, 05, 06 level, we're going to be way better served 5 and 10 years from now when you're in a command position.
Great advice, sir. Well, thank you so much for being with us today. We really appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
A box of books is like a care package for your brain. If your command library is looking a bit shabby, DoD Reads can help. We are connected to multiple organizations that would be glad to send your command free books, magazines, and high-quality reading material. Head over to dodreads.com and check out our featured article, 8 ways to request free books for your command. And then let us know, what are you reading?
Thanks for listening to this episode of What Are You Reading? A podcast produced through partnership with DoD Reads. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate, subscribe, and share it. Leave us a comment with your answer to the question, What Are You Reading? Also, visit dodreads.com for free books, book reviews, interviews with your favorite authors, and many more free professional development resources. See you next week.